This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
January 14th at 10 a.m. and Wednesday, January 17th at 6 p.m. They'll be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard, near downtown Houston. Visit kpft.org to RSVP for the training or just come on by. You're tuned in to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
This is the time of year to plant fruit trees in our area, and you can pick out one just right for your yard at the Urban Harvest Annual Fruit Tree Sale. The sale is located at 1900 Bering Drive, located between Westheimer and San Felipe, just outside the West Loop. There will be a large selection of citrus trees, peaches, plums, apples, pears, figs, pomegranates, grapes, blackberries, blueberries, persimmons, and this year, for the first time, there will be wonderful tropicals such as mango, starfruit, papaya, and guava. The sale will be held Saturday, January 20th from 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. with a free class from 8 a.m. until 9:20, and another free class January 10th from 7 to 9 p.m. Come early for best selection. The new large sales site has lots of on-site parking. For more information and directions, check out the Urban Harvest website at www.urbanharvest.org. Again, that web address is www.urbanharvest.org. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Walensky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Deborah Bell.
And Glenn Holt.
Tonight, we are going to be talking with Aaron Coleman, and he'll join us to talk about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and associate Bernard Rustin, the architect of the 1963 March on Washington, who was a gay man, actually openly gay at the time. Joan Devlin from Iowa will be interviewing Alexis Nissan.
Axel Nissan.
Author of the
Actresses of a certain character. I wonder what character that may be.
Could be. He is an openly gay professor of American Studies at the University of Oslo.
Which is in Oslo, Norway, strangely enough.
Well, really? Really. Bisexuals among us. Sally Huffer is
there
going to be talking about the invisible piece of the GLBT community. Continued discussion about the changes at Pride Houston, possibly moving the parade downtown and moving the time of celebration. And we're also going to be talking with the performances of women composers benefiting AIDS foundations, and that's the
Makuru.
And hopefully we'll have the Alley Theater Act Out programming, which is coming up on January 18th, Moon for the Misbegotten, also benefiting the AIDS Foundation of Houston. So all that's coming up on this edition of Queer Voices.
So first, Glenn is frantically signaling for us to stretch.
Well, we will be talking a little bit more in depth about what's going on at Pride Houston. I'm the founder of the organization and former employee, but no longer associated with them. And there was a big community meeting this past Saturday, and it was actually two stories in the Chronicle this week.
Yeah, very interesting that we're getting major coverage about what our community is doing.
We'll go into more discussion about that, but basically what's happened is that the board of Pride Houston is meeting tonight. They're probably finishing up their meeting now. But Carol White, who's the president, had made a commitment that no decision would be made this evening, that further discussion will be going on, because the number of people that showed up on Saturday were pretty much almost unanimously against it, but not quite.
Yeah. Well, there's some merits to some of the things that came out of the study that they've been doing, and there's still time to participate in the survey that's online at pridehouston.org. Because, you know, we have to look at what works, what doesn't work, and what's the best interest of this community. But it needs to come from the community. It doesn't just need to be an isolated board, because, for one thing, they're going to get their volunteers and people that are excited in participating in the parade from this community.
Well, the interesting thing was, is because we discussed this last week, mm-hmm. Alex Snyder of the Chronicle was actually Turner was listening to our show, and that's how the stories got in the Chronicle, and that's how all the publicity got generated.
Oh, so now we know who our listener is.
We know who it is. A good one, too. Well,
and we had some excellent comments made by the callers, and Jeffrey Kruler, who's the new director of operations for Pride. He was very gracious, and I know we kind of hit him with some hard balls because passions kind of run high on many sides.
I think anytime you open it up to the phones, which is rare for us, you're going to get people calling in to say they're the passionate ones. The ones that aren't very passionate don't bother even dialing the phone.
That's a good point. And we are nothing if we're not passionate.
Our listeners are passionate.
Okay, well, Glenn has given me the signal that he now is ready to play News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Charles Hall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 13th, 2007. The legislature in the northern Mexican state of Coahuila this week, by a vote of 20-13, approved a law recognizing same-gender unions. It's only the second legislative body in the predominantly Roman Catholic country to do so. The measure was drafted by the centrist Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. Governor Humberto Morera, who is also in the PRI, is expected to sign the bill into law. Coahuila, known primarily for mining and ranching, is one of Mexico's 31 states. It shares a border with the U.S. state of Texas along the Rio Grande River and has a population of about 2.5 million people. The Mexico City Assembly passed a similar law in November. The new legislation in Coahuila also covers state Social Security benefits. The Roman Catholic Church and the conservative National Action Party of Mexican President Felipe Calderón have been sharply critical of both measures. While homosexuality is still an unspoken subject in many rural parts of Latin America, where the Roman Catholic Church has considerable influence, the region's urban areas are becoming more socially progressive. Mexico City and Coahuila join the Argentine capital of Buenos Aires and the southern Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul in legally recognizing same-gender couples.
Same-gender couples in the UK gained virtually all the rights and responsibilities of marriage when the Civil Partnership Act became law in December 2005. But bias against gays and lesbians in the provision of goods and services is still perfectly legal there. Taking another step to change that, the House of Lords this week rejected a challenge to new laws in the United Kingdom that prohibit businesses from discrimination based on sexual orientation. By a vote of 199-68, peers upheld the Northern Ireland sexual orientation regulations, which came into force in the province on January 1st. Because of vocal opposition to the measure by religious groups, they aren't set to take effect in England and Wales until April. Proponents note that the new laws are similar to existing measures that ban bias on the basis of gender and race. But opponents argue that the regulations require religious organizations to violate the teachings of their faith. About 1,000 torch-bearing demonstrators from various religions, including Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, protested outside Parliament on the night of the vote. The Labour Party's Lord Smith of Finsbury, a former cabinet minister and the UK's first openly gay MP, said he was puzzled by Christian fundamentalist objections to sexual orientation anti-bias laws. What they are arguing for, he said, is quite simply the right to discriminate and the right to harass, and those arguments are being made in the name of Christianity. A lawsuit challenging the new laws, brought by the right-wing Christian Institute, will be heard by Northern Ireland's High Court in March.
Also in the UK, the Royal Air Force has become a member of queer advocacy group Stonewall's Diversity Champions in an effort to attract more gay and lesbian recruits. The force also is launching a major advertising campaign in the LGBT press, reportedly with a budget of tens of thousands of pounds. Member organizations of the Stonewall program are expected to do such things as sponsor pride events, create a gay, lesbian, bisexual staff organization, and extend pensions to same-gender couples. An unnamed Ministry of Defense spokesperson told London's Telegraph newspaper that the armed forces are committed to establishing a culture and climate where those who choose to disclose their sexual orientation can do so without risk of abuse or intimidation.
But Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which requires lesbian and gay service members to stay in the closet, is still the military law of the land in the United States. Both former Clinton-era Secretary of Defense William Cohen and former Joint Chiefs Chair John Shalikashvili have spoken out in recent weeks favoring repeal of the policy. Shalikashvili, who headed the Joint Chiefs of Staff when the policy was adopted in 1993, wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times this week saying that conversations he'd had with lesbi-gay service members showed me just how much the military has changed and that gays and lesbians can be accepted by their peers. Shalikashvili also cited a December Zogby poll commissioned by the Michael D. Palm Center at the University of California in Santa Barbara of 545 U.S. troops who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. It reported that three-quarters said that they were comfortable around lesbians and gay men. Nearly one in four said that they knew for certain that a member of his or her unit was gay or lesbian. C. Dixon Osborne of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, a lesbi-gay military rights group, called Shalikashvili's article in particular enormously significant. Polls in the last few years have shown that at least 58% to as much as 70% of the general public favors repealing the ban on openly lesbi-gay service members. 112 members from both parties in the new Congress have signed on as co-sponsors of the Military Readiness Enhancement Act, which would end the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, however, says that gays should never be allowed to govern mostly Muslim Malaysia. His statement came in a court filing challenging a lawsuit by his former deputy, Anwar Ibrahim. Anwar was fired by Mahathir amid allegations of corruption and sodomy in 1998, soon after Anwar publicly denounced Mahathir's economic policies. Mahathir's then heir apparent was convicted on those charges and sentenced to 15 years in prison. A successful appeal in Malaysia's top court against the sodomy conviction set Anwar free in 2004. Now a key opposition figure, he sued Mahathir for about $28 million the following year, after the ex-leader repeated the sodomy allegations at a human rights conference. I strongly believe we cannot have a prime minister who is homosexual, because Malaysia is officially an Islamic country, Mahathir said in the 48-page court statement filed late last week at the High Court in Kuala Lumpur and reviewed by the Associated Press. The former prime minister wrote that he had no doubt that Anwar had been proven to be a homosexual. Mahathir retired in 2003 after 22 years in power.
Meanwhile, an openly gay police officer in Missoula, Montana, is taking a one-year leave of absence to help train the National Police Force in mostly Muslim Afghanistan. Scott Oak told the Billings Gazette that the U.S. State Department contacted him following press coverage of his appointment as Missoula's first LGBT community police liaison. He says a large part of his role in Afghanistan will be to train officers in diversity and human and civil rights. He told the Gazette that he hopes his year in Kabul will enlighten them and that it will make for a smoother transition and allow America to pull out of there more quickly. A lot of people think I'm crazy, he said, but for me it's just another challenge and an opportunity to help people in need. His only regret is having to leave his partner of 12 years and the teenage foster son they are raising. Missoula Mayor John Engen says Oak's job will be waiting for him when he returns. Another officer, Nicole Pafari, has been named the city's interim LGBT police liaison officer.
A lesbian couple in the Canadian province of Alberta has exchanged wedding vows behind bars, a first for the Edmonton Institution for Women and possibly a first in the country. The women, who were not named by prison officials, met in the facility. One is serving a nearly three-year sentence for assault with a weapon, aggravated assault, and breaking and entering. She's scheduled for release in November. The other was incarcerated for manslaughter and assaulting a peace officer, and she's scheduled for release in December. Guards walked the women in handcuffs from their separate cells to a secure room. The cuffs were removed while a minister performed the ceremony, but armed guards watched over the proceeding. There won't be a honeymoon, however. Following the ceremony, the women will return to their separate cells. They won't be allowed to consummate the union until they're both out of jail. While the wedding is believed to be the first for lesbians behind bars in Canada, it's not the first same-gender prison ceremony. Two gay men were married last year in a penitentiary in Ontario. Same-gender marriage became legal in Canada in 2005.
And finally, the UK Pink News website reported exclusively this week that three gay businessmen in Manhattan's West Village are spearheading the salvation of what many consider to be the birthplace of the modern LGBT rights movement. Pink News reports that Bill Morgan and Tony DeChico, who own the Duplex Bar in the West Village, along with Village entrepreneur Kurt Kelly, were alarmed when they heard about the imminent closure of the Stonewall Inn. On a hot summer night in late June 1969, customers there stood up for their rights and rioted, fed up with years of routine police harassment. News of the uprising spread rapidly, and within 12 months, there were organized lesbi-gay rights groups in major cities across the U.S. and in many other parts of the world. Once a refuge for drag queens and other outcasts, the Stonewall Inn had in recent years lapsed into disrepair, and the clientele had fallen off. Morgan told Pink News that, "We spoke with the landlord and let them know that we were interested in keeping the Stonewall, as it has such an important place in both the West Village and in gay rights history. The club had been mismanaged and had become a bad neighbor in the community due to excessive noise, underage people being served, and questionable after-hours business being conducted. Morgan says he was overwhelmed by the response from New Yorkers when he issued an appeal for other investors. People came out of the woodwork, he said, gay and straight. Everyone recognized the potential loss to the community both here and the gay community worldwide. Pending the approval of a liquor license, the new owners hope to open the doors of the newly renovated Stonewall Inn on February 1st.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 13th, 2007, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Charles Hall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
queen. And I'm not going anywhere. So get used to it. I'm here. I'm queen.
From 1998, that was Mark Islam with his song, Get Used to It. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you, Glenn. Get used to it. That's what I want the people to do. I want, I can't say this very diplomatically, but...
Well, then don't be diplomatic.
If something should happen to George W. Bush, and then Cheney heard about it, and he, had a heart attack, then Nancy Pelosi, the first woman Speaker of the House, would become president. And then she would appoint Barack Obama to be her vice president, so you'd have a woman president and a black man as vice president, and all those old white guys would just have to deal with it. So that was a great segue song. Of course, this is the anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., civil rights leader, who one of the many things that he said, the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. And that certainly... where we are, we're in times of challenge and controversy. And in commemorating this day, this important day of honoring a man that did so much for so many, I invited our friend Aaron Coleman, who's a wonderful poet and artist, to talk about the legacy of Dr. King and his associate, Bayard Rustin, who was the architect of the 1963 March on Washington and also was a gay man. So how are you tonight, Aaron, besides chilly?
Real chilly. I'm fine. Hi, Houston. How are you? I'm glad to be here. And when Deb asks you to do something, it's homework.
You so. Better do it.
Yeah.
I wish there were more people that felt that way.
So I looked some things up, and I came up with about Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King. When we think of Martin Luther King, we're usually confronted with an image of a man that, according to Dr. Cornel West, the esteemed professor of religion at Harvard and noted author, that has undergone Santa Clausification is the way he termed it. Mm. That is to say, a sterile, huggable, congenial figure placed on a proverbial pedestal who won the Nobel Peace Prize, gave a remarkable speech on a cold winter's morning in 1963, has a holiday named for him, when he was much more and much less. A contradiction. He was a man. An ordinary man, according to West, who mustered incredible courage to think for himself, and in doing so pointed out injustices with his, at times quiet and other times vocal, activism, reaching outside of himself for the unselfish benefit of us all. Now, Bayard Rustin, contrary to popular belief, was the architect behind the scenes, laying the groundwork for King to optimize their shared vision, which is embodied in King's I Have a Dream speech. It was Rustin, according to Ann Rostow, the contributing writer for the Texas Triangle, who infused King and his followers with a commitment to nonviolence, and who thought up the idea of getting a mixed group to ride on interstate buses with whites in the back and blacks in the front. According to Rustin's friend and ally, Charles Bloomstein, Dr. King will go down in history as Lincoln did after the Gettysburg Address. But if there had been violence that day, the media would have seized upon it and King's great speech would have been drowned out. Rustin's masterful planning in the march at the time, the largest mass demonstration in U.S. history, made King's speech possible and meaningful. From the logistics of having buses chartered, food prepared, a makeshift security force in place, water spigots installed along the march route, blankets, toilets, medical facilities, publicizing with flyers, all allegedly the brainchild of Rustin, a gay man, an openly gay man who spoke with an upper-class British accent acquired from one of his favorite high school teachers who loved Baroque music, appreciated art and fine food, prone to exaggeration and practical jokes, and to his bane, sleeping around. A man.
We are shocked.
A man who could speak fluently without notes on a range of topics and could captivate an audience. A true behind the scenes unsung hero.
Wasn't the march in August? August of 63?
I think it seems like,
because you said a cold winter's day, I'm going, wait a minute, I think it was in August.
It was. It was hot and sweltering.
His birthday is in January, which tomorrow is my birthday, and guess what? It's usually
a cold
dad burn cold.
Like tonight.
Happy birthday, Dad.
Well, thanks. Thanks, dear friend. Thanks for the sweet little present you brought me.
Well, thank you for that correction.
And of course, we were reminiscing earlier about our memories of seeing that speech on television and our awareness of what was going on, part of the history of the world that we were witness to. And is it tonight that they're starting the Eyes on the Prize? It's going to be on PBS.
They're
rerunning that. Must see. Everyone must see that. So what else did you discover in kind of looking into Dr. King's life?
I think that he's a figure that's hard to put in a box. He was an ordinary man, but he embodied the greatness of this country. He brought us to realization that we're all the same. We're all brothers. And it's through his legacy that we keep the dream alive.
Right, right. Keep the dream alive. I think that one line about being measured by the nature of your character rather than the color of your skin It's
the content of your character.
Yes, the content of your
character. It's my favorite quote.
Yes.
Especially when you run up against the prejudice in our own community, the GLBT community. You know, I remember that speech.
He was against all forms of prejudice and bias.
And certainly, and by following, as you said, it was Rustin's influence, the Gandhi practice of nonviolent civil disobedience, which is something that within the GLBT movement we sometimes have strayed from, but in the feminist movement that I've been such a strong part of, we don't participate in anything unless that's the criteria. It has to be non-violence, civil disobedience.
Well, it's proven to be the strong point of the movement. It's to encompass the vision of Gandhi,
right?
Which was non-violence.
Which again, it brings me to the people that make true revolution are those that have nothing to lose by doing so.
It's incredibly courageous,
yes,
to do that.
Yes, and so that movement certainly is one that we build on, although some people get upset when we compare the GLBT rights movement to being anything like the civil rights movement for African Americans in this country. But to me, and this is the phrase that we used in the 1993 March on Washington for lesbian, gay, bi, equal rights and liberation. It's the unfinished civil rights agenda. It's a simple matter of justice.
For all humans.
Exactly.
Regardless of gender or preference or, mm-hmm, or creed.
Right. You've been inspired to do some of your own writing in honor of Dr. King.
I've written two poems, and I brought them with me. The first one is, Have You a Dream? Have you a dream like Dr. King, that all men can live as brothers, girded with strength and encouragement from any whom would seem other? He suggested that we all be led by our collective moral compass, which would ensure protection for our young, our old, our weak, those who dream the American dream, but glean nothing more than false hopes, broken promises, and taxation of spirit. The champion is gone, martyred, an imperfect saint, canonized by his belief in and love of God and man, left us with the unfinished task, a behemoth, to overcome racism, poverty, inequality, injustice, bigotry, hate, and war. Soldiers are needed in this fight, not only for country, but duty to mankind, the passengers on spaceship Earth. Have you a dream?
Oh, wow.
That's so good.
That's the one that you just, that's all you can say is, wow. Mm. That is wonderful, Aaron. I love it. Spaceship Earth, and we're in a lot of danger on Spaceship Earth right now. And at the end of this month, the 28th of January, there is a major march on Washington. I can't remember what they're calling it right now, but it's against the war effort and for peace. Hopefully that will be a big march and maybe get some people's attention to say, we are a democracy, we decide, not you. And we know who you is in that sentence. I think that we do share the dream. We share the dream and we have our own dreams about inclusion and being allies to one another. Mm-hmm.
It's a spaceship Earth. I mean, you know, we only have one planet, and, there have been various pundits, and there's a certain movie out called An Inconvenient Truth that signals the fact that, you know, we have to take care of this planet. We only have one. And it's not about nation against nation or this one against that one. It's about us all coming together for the greater good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
the
this 2007.
Example. Yeah.
And people are acting, you know, like caveman days. It's ridiculous.
Uh-oh, don't go insulting those cavemen. That'll get you in trouble. I've seen those commercials.
I watch those commercials,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I love those.
You know, one thing, it's about, for me, it's always about, you know, liberty and equality and respect for one another. I mean, that isn't that what everybody wants, no matter where you
it's
are?
It's kind of like that
coming.
Jesus thing. Do unto others as you would have
exactly.
them do unto you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you have another piece, and yes. our guest for this segment in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has been Aaron Coleman and Jennifer Renee, and I are just going to listen to some more of his lovely work.
One morning, I remember the flashback journey of roots. Transfixed I was to a technological development of the 20th century, watching images of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries with the blood of those players portrayed running, coursing through my veins. Surreal. Had I ever imagined how it was, how it could have been? The Middle Passage. Boats, shackles, and chains. Cargo bound for the promised land. The only thing guaranteed, taxes compounded, and death prolonged. The journey of the slave. From downright defiance to quiet indignation, but never complacency. Always striving, always singing, praying to God for deliverance, all on that day. That great day in the morning. Joy comes in the morning. And I've seen several mornings in my lifetime. One morning, I saw the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. One morning, I saw the March on Washington and actually heard Martin Luther King deliver his I Have a Dream speech. One morning, I saw Shirley Chisholm being tutored for President of the United States in 1972. One morning, I saw the Challenger space shuttle lift off carrying Guyon Bluford, the first African-American, into space. One bright, crisp morning, I saw Maya Angelou deliver her poem, On the Pulse of Morning, for President Clinton's inaugural, and my breast swole. And I was moved to tears because here was the fulfillment of America's promise, of the American dream, the only requirement being merely to dream.
That's another
Thank you.
Oh,
that was
wow.
wonderful.
That's
oh.
another oh wow. Well, I know you asked about Joan earlier, so you give her a shout out.
Joan, I miss
hey,
you, baby.
Aaron.
How are
I miss you?
You
too. How are you doing?
Happy New Year.
All
Happy
right.
New Year. You're amazing.
Yeah,
Thank
thanks
you.
For being with us on Queer Voices. And
Thank
now
you for having me.
We have Joan Devlin, our Iowa correspondent, with an interview with Axel Nisson, the author of Actresses of a Certain Character.
Yes, Axel, are you with us? And good morning to you.
Well, good night, or very early good morning. I certainly am with you, Joan.
Excellent.
In spirit, if not in body.
Now, Axel, you've written an absolutely wonderful book here. It's called Actresses of a Certain Character, 40 Familiar Hollywood Faces from the 30s to the 50s, and it encompasses many people we've heard of and many people we've probably seen, but we never knew their names. And they're all women, and I've noticed, looking at the beginning of your book, a lot of them were born in the 1800s, as a matter of fact. What made you decide to write a book like this?
Well, I thought you'd ask me that, so I've been trying to think back. This has been a process going on for about, well, 3 or 4 years now. And funnily enough, it really started with an entirely different project. I was going to write a book on the diva phenomenon. And I was looking at a lot of old films with Marlene Dietrich and, you know, Tallulah Bankhead and things. And I started
hello?
Noticing some of the other women in those films. You know, the mothers and the sisters and the old spinster aunts and the mammies. And I thought, wow, they're really talented. They're really making an important contribution to these films. And lo and behold, here we are 4 years later, and I've written a book about them. Hello?
Well, sounds like we may have lost Joan for some reason.
Yeah, she's back.
Oops. All right. Well, sounds like we lost everybody. We're going to have to retry that one again. Let me bring Deborah up. Right. Hey, Deborah.
Joan? Stretch out and tap dance here. So.
As usual, you want me to play a piece of music while we get
that would be so lovely.
Put it back together? All right, let's do that.
Okay, we lost Axel.
Okay, we have managed to reestablish the connection between Joan Devlin in Iowa and her guest in Norway. Go ahead, Joan.
Yes, okay, Axel, let's start again. What made you decide to write the book on character actresses?
Well, I was explaining in detail, I'll try to give you the short version now, that I'd originally intended to write an entirely different book, a book that was going to be all about the diva phenomenon. And so I started looking at these old films with, you know, Marlene Dietrich and Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, and all of a sudden I started noticing even more, you know, the actresses who were sort of always two steps behind, the mothers and the sisters and the mammies and the spinster aunts. And I realized, you know, they were really talented and they were making such a vast contribution to these films, so I decided to write a book about them instead.
Great. And how hard was it to find some of the information on these women? For instance, you have people like Elizabeth Patterson, who is best known for playing Mrs. Trumbull on I Love Lucy. You have Alice Pierce, who was the original Mrs. Kravitz on Bewitched. You have people, you know, Anne Revere, Elizabeth Risden. These are not, you know, names that are easily recognized, even among the film community.
Exactly. That's one of the nice things about writing a book like this, is that you're able to regenerate a lot of lost knowledge about these actresses, because many of them were actually, you know, also had a long and varied experience in live theater behind them. Some of them had even been Broadway stars. Obviously, Ethel Barrymore is the most prominent example of that. So it was relatively easy in some cases to find information about them, but the hard part was often getting hold of their films. And that's where I really expended most of my time, and I might add also money, in trying to dig up, you know, I wanted to be able to see as many films as possible for each of these 40 actresses.
And you actually had come to this country. That's where you and I met when you were researching Agnes Moorehead in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
And where else did your journey take you as you tried to find out information about these women? Because you met some very interesting people along the way, including one who wrote the foreword for your book.
Well, that's an interesting story in itself. You know, I thought I would try to do a job in contacting some of the surviving stars, some of the female stars who had obviously benefited from the support, because that's what they were called, you know, supporting players, of these long, in most cases, long dead women. All the women in the book have passed away. And most of them were born, like you said, before 1900. So there's just no chance of ever meeting them. But as I have to regret to report, in most cases, these stars were entirely unresponsive to my letters. But there was one exception, and that was Olivia de Havilland. I think we can safely call her the last surviving major star of the 1930s, and she's certainly the last star of Gone with the Wind. And she, from the very beginning, has been very supportive of this project, and I must have had about 20 letters from her now. And ultimately, I thought, well, why not ask her to write a foreword? All she can say is, you know, all I can get is a no. And she was actually able to make time in her schedule to do that, so I really appreciated it.
Now, you didn't just cover the film career of these women. You covered their personal lives, and quite a few of them did have kind of a gay subtext. Some of them were actually gay. How difficult was it to find out that kind of information?
Well, I don't. Maybe you're giving me a bit more credit than I deserve here. I don't know if I really, you know, uncovered any vast revelations, but I felt, you know, it was my responsibility to try to at least bring forth whatever information there was. The most out character actress is actually not in a separate profile in the book. That's an actress called Patsy Kelly, who some may recall from films and from what she was in Rosemary's Baby, was one of her last films. But she's the only example I can really think of a really out, you know, lesbian with a lesbian identity. In most cases, these women lived sort of shadowy lives. They were either widows or unmarried, and there have been all kinds of rumors. Obviously, we've heard the rumors about Inez Moorhead, but there's also rumors about someone like Marjorie Main, Ma Kettle in a number of films, and Spring Byington as well. So basically, it's on the level of rumor more than fact.
And you know, but these rumors have pursued these women in some cases, you know, long after, unfortunately, you don't see their films anymore. And
well, it is fascinating, and I sometimes wonder, I mean, in some cases, I mean, Agnes Moorhead is, of course, I know you'll be welcome any discussion on Agnes Moorhead, so I can use her as an example. She's actually someone who I would almost claim the rumors started after she died, you know? I mean, I don't know how many rumors there actually were while she was alive. It seems to have become a whole industry, you know, after 1974 and her passing. And we all know, of course, that it really started with that famous quote from Paul Lynn calling her, you know, the biggest dyke in Hollywood or something like that. And everything seems to have sort of spun out from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did it take you to put this book together? Because the research is exhaustive. You go through film careers, personal lives. You've got 40 different women in here. About how long did it take you to put all of this together?
Well, I was trying to think back. I think about 3 years. Obviously not working full-time because I'm really a literature professor and I write, you know, in my work, I usually write a whole different kind of a book and a whole different kind of research. But this has been sort of a hobby project for me that I've spent my evenings and weekends doing. And it's been a pure labor of love. It's just been probably the most fun I ever had writing a book. So I don't want to make it seem like a real chore at all. But it's taken time and it's taken a lot of money, too, because I found that in addition to the movies and the DVDs and the video cassettes, I wanted to begin collecting some film stills as well. So actually all the photographs in the book are from my own personal collection. And that's been a lot of fun as well, I must say.
Great. And how has the book is called Actresses of a Certain Character. I want to keep repeating that, Actresses of a Certain Character. And I want to know, how has it been selling so far? It came out, what, October, November time frame?
To be honest, I have no idea. I remember my agent, when I came to him with his project, he looked at me and he said, "This is a wonderful idea, Axel, but don't count on building a house." And I said to him, "Listen, I already have a house, so I would never embark on a project like this with any expectation of, you know, making any real money from it. That's just in the nature of the game. So we'll have to see. I'll know when the royalty statements come in. I haven't had any checks yet, let's put it that way."
So, well, maybe we can get you some. What can people do to get this book? Where can they go?
Well, you know, Amazon.com is probably the easiest suggestion I can make. Or they can order it directly from McFarland. McFarlandPub.com, that's the publisher. But it's available in any internet bookstore. And I've also heard that it's been observed in Barnes & Noble, which I thought was a pretty cheerful thing. You know, very few books with a so-called, you know, specialist audience get into these big book chains these days. But someone had seen my book in there, so, hey. You can go into your neighborhood bookstore, or if you if you have a film specialty store in your town, maybe that would be a good way to sort of support your local bookstore as well. And if they don't have it, you can get them to order it.
Great, and you are working on another book now, which is more directly about Agnes Moorehead. So can you kind of give a preview of that one? Although I know it's
not only directly, it's entirely dedicated to her. It's going to be a comprehensive scholarly biography of Agnes Moorehead. I was a bit in doubt about whether I wanted to do a book just on her films or, you know, go the whole hog and try to do a really big, big biography on her. And I think it's going to be the latter. It looks that way. I've been doing a lot of uncovering a lot of interesting, there's quite a lot of documentation on Agnes Moorehead's life, which of course makes it a very exciting and interesting journey for me. But it'll take a few years before we'll be doing an interview about that book, I suspect.
Right. So right now, though, people can get your this book. Is this your first book or your second book?
No, this is actually, I think, my fourth.
Well, people can get your first book, Actresses of a Certain Character, 40 Familiar Hollywood Faces from the 30s to the 50s. For anyone who is into film, this is a must-have book. You get, you know, I mean, there have been books written on character actresses before, but you got at most one or two pages, maybe a couple of photographs. This book, I mean, it's almost like each chapter could be a book in itself. These are just absolutely in-depth, wonderful essays, wonderful pictures of so many different people that contributed to classic Hollywood film. The book is available, as you said, all over. And again, it is called Actresses of a Certain Character. And Axel, I want to thank you because we know it is about 4 a.m. where you are, so we do appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight.
Well, I'm very glad I did, Joan. I've enjoyed it, and I want to thank you for those rousing words. I couldn't have put it better myself.
Thank you. And this, you're listening to Queer Voices.
If your heart always did what a normal heart should do, if you always play a part instead of being who you are, then you might just miss the one who's standing there. So instead of passing by, show him that you care. Instead of that we're taught, never questioning the rules that we're living lies we bought so long ago. How are they to know it's not who's wrong or right? It's just another way. I don't want to fight, but no, I'm gonna stay with you to the end, with you. Cause love don't need visa. don't have is time.
To discover what KPFT is like during its most energetic moments, now's your chance. Starting in late January, KPFT kicks off its Winter Pledge Drive, and we need your help to make it a success. You can put your spare time to use by volunteering to answer phones during the drive. Our phone volunteer trainings are Sunday, January 14th at 10 a.m. and Wednesday, January 17th at 6 p.m. The sessions will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard. You'll meet KPFT listeners just like you, make new friends, and help this community radio station. In just an hour or two, you can help us handle pledges. Your efforts make a difference, and you can make this a fun and successful drive. Evenings and weekends are available. Again, those phone volunteer training dates are Sunday, January 14th at 10 a.m. and Wednesday, January 17th at 6 p.m. They'll be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard near downtown Houston. Visit kpft.org to RSVP for the training or just come on by. You're tuned in to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
And just before that announcement, we heard from Michael Callen and his song Love Don't Need a Reason from 1989. This is Queer Voices.
That song from Michael Callen is probably one of my all-time favorites.
It's beautiful.
It's a very good song.
I was telling Jennifer that I had the pleasure of hearing him sing it probably about 8 times before we lost him to AIDS. And he was, of course, part of the group called The Flirtations. One of the primary people to start the gay man's health crisis in New York. So he's very much missed.
I think, was he in the movie Philadelphia?
Yes. I think there was a scene where they were singing, yes. Gosh, if you hadn't asked me that, I wouldn't have remembered.
Well, speaking of remembering, it's birthday season, isn't it?
It is. So we got a shout out to Jimmy Carper, because he's a Capricorn birthday too. And your birthday was last week.
Yes, last Thursday.
And there was a lovely gathering of friends on Friday night at Van Locke.
Yes, although I sort of lost my hearing that night because you were so loud. Sitting next to me. And your birthday
considering
is?
That Ed Barnes, your social secretary, set it up, was across the table, and some of the other people there, I was quiet in comparison to many of them.
Ellie brought in baklava, so we had happy baklava to you.
That's right.
And
that's
when is your birthday, Deb?
Well, mine's tomorrow. So you can lavish all the presents you want upon me.
You've already received my present.
I know, darling. just knowing you is a present in itself. But Glenn had a December birthday, so we were also celebrating for him. And
your presents all make noises when you turn them on.
And they vibrate.
It sort of looks like a little space thing or something.
Yeah, it's got lights on it. It's a little mini massager, and it's really cute. And you know, actually, they're very nice on your neck.
You're always complaining about your neck. And
I was over in Nolens this past weekend.
Yeah, how was that?
Nolens.
We had the annual Mardi Gras volleyball classic over there. The New Orleans League hosts this thing every year for volleyball. And so I was one of several teams from Houston that went over there.
My team
that I was the captain of.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, we didn't do very well this time.
I'm sorry to hear that.
That's just how that goes. But the city itself is interesting. I mean,
what kind of shape is the city in now?
Extremely clean, which surprised me. I mean, we were only in the French Quarter area, but I always remember a lot of sort of dirt and stuff. Well, and
when you wake up in the gutter too many times, you know how dirty it is.
But No, it was extremely clean. The sidewalks were kind of like missing slate in pieces and kind of a little broken up here and there. So, I mean, it's they're on their way back, but they've still got a ways to go. And that's in the good part, you know, the area that wasn't hit all that hard. We didn't even see some of the other areas that apparently are still recovering.
Well, a lot of people say New Orleans will never really come back. It'll be what it once was. And that's really something to be mourned.
Look at Pompeii.
Wow, talk about left field.
Okay.
Yeah, really. So,
And we have a lot of natural disasters going on right now with the weather, and thank God it's not going to be that bad here in Houston. Yeah, but I do want everyone to be careful out there on the roads.
Absolutely. Be careful driving out there later on tonight when this
overpasses, and maybe take your regular route if you need to go up on highway and things, but
stay off the freeway if you can,
and don't go 80 on the beltway. Just take it easy and take care so that you're safe and that everyone else around you. I saw a car that had come off a ramp. This was on Sunday when the streets were just a little bit slick. And it was like, at first I'm saying, there's cop cars, there's the ambulance, there's the tow trucks, what's going on? Because I couldn't see a car that was wrecked. And finally, it was in the bushes, and it was like,
Nose down in the bushes.
It was horrifying.
I remember being nose down in the bushes.
That is a whole different story.
Ellie can tell you the website to go to check for road conditions. It's TxDOT something or other, right?
Ellie, what is that website?
Do you know that one offhand?
Oh, no, actually I don't.
You can probably just, the one thing you don't know,
spot,
okay.
Didn't we?
Probably Google TxDOT. I mean, it's
Google.com, XY.
Yeah, and then,
TxDOT.
Transtar is one, but also any of the television station news websites usually have that information. And they're, in fact, they're talking about it now. It's like that's the big news. It's the weather.
Only news.
Right, and so just remember that whenever we get freezing around here, there's the three things that you need to take care of: your plants, your pipes, and your pets. And so you want to bring your pipes in, and you want to wrap your pets and smoke your plants.
And that's always what I do.
Guess what? It's 9 o'clock.
I was so glad that you were saying all those P's and not me.
Maybe I should get out of this by playing our bridge, okay?
Well, it's 9 o'clock, as Jack reminded us, and that's for time for us to say this is KPFT Houston.
And do this. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew. And so, Deborah, while you're getting stuff set up, Ellie, you're going to be heading off to law school. This is something new for you because you've been sort of interning with us while you've been getting your stuff put together, and now you're on your way.
Yeah, I'm going to the South Texas College of Law. It's just down the street here, virtually, and I'm having it's only day three and orientation only. I'm already kind of wondering, wait, can I actually do this?
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah. I know it's a shock at first, but once you get into the rhythm of it, you'll be fine. But we won't be seeing that much of you or hearing much of you.
I'll stop by randomly, so you might hear a random hello.
Okay. Well, hopefully.
Yeah. It's all for the best.
Am I getting nodding heads now from Deborah?
I'm ready when you are, Glenn.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so there's we hear GLBT, and that's gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and it used to be, as Jennifer says, the T was
silent.
But the T hasn't been silent for a while.
Not since I got here,
and
I'll
that's
say.
Right. Yeah,
last 15 months.
We've been not only on this show, but in the community, the transgender component of the queer community has been more visible.
visible and active and more accepted. But there's always this group of people, and we have it in there in that alphabet soup, but we don't really know who the bisexuals are.
Yeah, and they're out there.
Well, there are people that argue that there's no such thing, etc. We have two people here with us tonight. One is Joy, and how do you pronounce that last name?
Pitaro.
Pitaro. Joy Pitaro and Sally Huffer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Sally's our dear friend that comes over from the Montrose Counseling Center. But tonight she's not here to talk about things going on there. She's coming from a personal a place. So let's talk a little bit about, is there such a thing as a bisexual?
Well, I've always said that as long as Elizabeth Shue and Keith Olbermann are going to live in this world, that yes, there is.
And who are they?
Oh, they're just two people that I find incredibly attractive.
Oh.
One's an actress. One is a news commentator.
Thought we were going to get a scoop here.
Yeah.
No. I always tell people it's kind of like trying to be a vegetarian as long as the pepperoni is going to exist. I can't do it.
I see. And, of course, some people say it increases your chance of having a date.
Yes. You have 6 billion opportunities that way.
There you go.
Doubles your chance of a date on Saturday night.
Yeah. Right. And Joy, she just before we went on, she says, oh, yes, I have to call my husband to remind him that this is on, it's going to be on. So Joy, you identify as bisexual and you're married.
Yes.
But you were in a long-term relationship with a woman prior to your marriage.
Yes. Actually, I was exclusively lesbian for 19 years as far as being with partners. However, during those years, I was attracted to men at various times. I didn't act on it, but I acknowledged the attraction there. And there's a perspective that you get over the lifetime of any individual. You start to realize, oh, okay, I was aware of this back then. I didn't know what to call it, and this was going on, and this was subdued at this point, and when I was with this person, I was more this way than that way. So I know people who say, well, I used to be bisexual, but now I'm married, and so I'm heterosexual, and I think, well, no, you're probably still bisexual. It's just now that you're with a heterosexual partner, and it doesn't change anything.
Or they say, I was bisexual, but now I'm gay because I'm with
a same-sex
partner.
Yeah, that can happen too. And I think that bisexual is an identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a behavior.
Right.
Because the sex is the behavior. You can be heterosexual your whole life and never have sex. And so, well, how can you prove?
How can you prove you're heterosexual?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the same thing with bisexuality. Just because you're bi doesn't mean you have sex with both sexes. It means that you are attracted to both sexes.
Right. Would you say that it's an equal attraction?
Doesn't have to be, because, you know, there's that Kinsey scale.
Right.
That goes from 1 to 7. I love that scale because it stops people from putting you in 3 distinct categories. You're either hetero, homo, or bi, or, you know, people think bi is just confused, whatever. And, you know, there's more than just 3. There's more than just 2,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I like 7 because I put myself square on 4. I really do.
I love it.
But I know a lot of other bisexual people who don't consider themselves 4s. They consider themselves, well, I'm a 2.5, I'm a 4.5 or something, because I'm primarily lesbian, but I can still be attracted to a man given the right characteristics and vice versa.
Well, but I think it's really hard for a lot of people to acknowledge their own bisexuality because of the politics surrounding it. Because
mm-hmm.
I've talked to an awful lot of people who self-identify very strongly with the lesbian community or the gay community, but then in private they've taken me aside and said, you know, I really think I am more bisexual than I, but here I am, this out lesbian, and I'm this out gay man, and because they've got this public identity, they are almost afraid to pursue that other side of their sexuality.
They feel like they are betraying the lesbian community.
Mm-hmm.
And because there are women in the lesbian community who are less prone to associate with men, and some who are separatists, and so some bisexuals are very reluctant to go against that kind of, to, you know, they want to respect those women who feel like no women at all.
Sure.
And so we kind of avoid the subject.
And then when you don't really acknowledge that there's such a thing as bisexuality, that kind of does that extreme either-or thing where people such as Anne Heche or Joanne Lewentland, who is a prominent therapist who for many, many years worked and got her made her living off of writing books and doing presentations to the lesbian community, then leaves her lesbian partner and is with a man. And
now she's identifying as straight, right?
I don't know what she's identifying
as. Well, I hope she identifies as bisexual because that, to me, is what she is. That's what it appears to me to be.
Yeah. And then we have people like Patricia Ireland, who was the national president of the National Organization for Women, and she was married, and she became lovers with a woman, and she never would say, she would not use any term. She wouldn't say I'm bisexual, and she wouldn't say I'm lesbian, and she wouldn't say I'm straight either. So people you know, because she was in a very political position, and I think for me it's like, hey, there's no rules about how to be a lesbian. I mean, I didn't become a lesbian to be told how I should dress and that I, you know, if I can't wear nail polish or I have to wear my hair a certain way or, you know, silly rules like that.
Try being a T.
Yes. And that brings up another topic, Jennifer, because you yourself... You used to say that you, that you didn't become
gay until I became a woman.
Right. But in fact, you've had relationships with both men and women.
Yes.
And you prefer
women.
Right. But you're not totally opposed to being.
Yeah, on that scale, I'm somewhere, you know, three or five, whichever direction that scale goes.
Yeah, I don't know which end is heterosexual and which end is exclusively homosexual.
Yeah, in the dark, I'm the same way.
Griswold was to join us tonight and speaking as a male bisexual, and he had a medical reason that he, you know, something came up and he wasn't able to be here. So we're hoping to have him on in the future. To talk about that. But okay, everyone, this is like, okay, the big shocker. I too am a bisexual.
Oh my.
And I have had arguments with people who wanted to insist that I couldn't be a bisexual, and they were doing it based on being equally attracted to men or women. I'm more attracted to women, but I'm, you know, certainly not opposed to relationships with men, if that should happen. I don't foresee a way that it's going to happen. I'm not even having any luck with women.
When you're not having any at all, what are we?
I know. I celibate, but not by choice.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's important to separate the behavior from the orientation.
Or the identity. Because I would identify as lesbian, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah, but if you have bisexuality in your past, there's no guarantee that it will be in your future.
I was married. I gave birth to two children.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so, you know, we all, and that's another thing. People think you always are one or the other, or, you know, you always were bisexual, or you're always, people, things can change in your life, and there are many possibilities to be open to. Judy, I think your Joy, I think your case is really interesting because your husband, when you met him, you met him in a group that was conducive to getting to know him and his politics and his views.
Right. It was a discussion group, and so it was really neat to get to know somebody without having to be on a date one-to-one, because in a group you're much more relaxed and you're more likely to speak your views and be yourself. And it's a great way to make lots of friends, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I got to know him from the inside out, I say.
And then he was aware of your past history of having had a long-term relationship with a woman.
Right, right.
And that didn't scare him?
Nope. To his credit. You know,
I'll say to his credit, because I mean, either men or women usually become threatened by finding out that I'm bisexual.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Probably a lot of people out there, I mean, if they know me from the counseling center, either assume that I'm either straight or gay, but never really knew that I was bisexual,
right,
and that's how I identify.
So I'm getting messages from people that bisexuality scares people.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's scary because one of the things I think, and I've had to delve into, why would it scare people? Let me think. Okay, it must threaten family somehow.
Mm.
You know, people think that bisexuals must be swingers,
mm-hmm.
and they must be promiscuous,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, if they are attracted to everybody, you know, which is not true. No, we're not attracted to everybody. We're attracted to a certain set of characteristics, which then can manifest in either a male or a female, you know? I like people who are artistic, intellectual, you know, musical, that kind of thing. And that could be either gender. It doesn't have to be male or female. But I think that people are afraid of how bisexuals would enter their lives or break up their families, you know. And has anybody ever had any experience
what I hear more often than not, like among lesbians, like on personal ads or some kind of chat thing. I don't go into chat rooms, but I just heard about people talking about, they're always afraid of that, well, I'll get involved with a bisexual woman, and then she's going to want to go be with a man, or she'll meet a man.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that's part of it, is because they feel like there's more chances of them, you know.
But let's face it. I mean, anytime you enter into a relationship, you're taking a risk that that person is going to stay interested in you. And so, I mean, and I do understand why a lot of people are not interested. I mean, I've seen a lot of people who say, oh, I won't date bisexuals. I mean, as a general rule, and I think that it comes from a place where, I mean, I know people who have dated bisexuals, or I guess more accurately, bicurious people, and they haven't been open and honest about their bicuriosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, let's face it, that would be a scary situation to go into when somebody was bicurious, but also realizing that if you reduce your chances of finding a date if you admit that you're bicurious, then you get involved in the relationship, you find out that this really isn't what you're looking for, and then you go back to
whatever you were before.
Right, exactly. But that can be damaging. I mean, you're playing with somebody's heart here.
That's
and
true.
So, you know, I can understand why, and even if it doesn't happen to you, everybody knows somebody that happened to.
When I was married and before I came out, because I always knew that I was attracted to both men and women. Since a teenager, I knew that I was. But I guess the option of being a lesbian didn't occur to me. And you know, I don't have any regrets about having been married, and certainly not by having my wonderful children, but it was kind of interesting how I came to accept it. I was already around a lot of lesbians and knew a lot of lesbians, but I've known through the years a number of women that either have been with men or women, usually not at the same time. They're serially monogamous like most lesbians are, mm-hmm. but their partner may be man or a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who just this weekend was telling me about a new person in her life, and I said, oh, I never have a chance with you. You're always moving on to another woman before I ever get a chance with you. And she says, it's a guy. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh. And she says, and it's the second guy in the last several months. And I'm like, oh. But, you know, I knew she had a history of being bi. And she's telling me about this wonderful man who's come into her life, and I'm like, I couldn't be happier for her.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
right.
there's some men that it's like she's got a better deal with this guy than some of the women she's been with.
Yeah.
You know, we always think we're going to be with women and somehow just magically going to be okay. Everything's going to be wonderful. You'd like to be what?
I just like to be with somebody.
Yeah, me too. You and me both, Jennifer.
I think also we're afraid we're not going to be accepted as bisexual, and so we have a tendency to keep it a secret. But I remember once going to women's group, and after marrying Tom, and not hoping I would be accepted by the lesbians there, is like, is it okay if I'm married now? And they said, yes. I said, oh, thank you.
Well, if we accept straight women that are married, why shouldn't we accept anyone else?
Yeah.
I think that's the interesting thing, though, is because if you don't say it, No one's going to know because it's going to be assumed that you're heterosexual because you're in a married, you know, relationship with a man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I worked at the counseling center, Sally, that was the only time my gaydar got screwed up. I never knew who was straight, who was gay. Cause, you know, nobody... I think some people were a little timid about admitting they were straight, but there were also some people that had to assert that they were, in fact, gay. And
oh God.
A person who I love beyond belief, very dear to me, have known a long time, worked there. I don't know if he still does. And I thought he was gay. And I would always talk about, oh, he's just the kind of guy that you know, women just, if only he was straight, if only he was straight. And then later I found out that he is straight, much to my dismay. So that's really interesting how that can happen. So why do you say I'm bisexual?
Well, because I want to acknowledge that there is diversity in the population, and just like I wanted to be known as a lesbian to certain people in certain times and places, you know, where it was appropriate or, you know, the relationship was important enough, I also want people, those same people, to know that I'm bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
So that people don't make wrong assumptions, for one thing, and so that they can know more about the truth about me, and so that they can be cognizant that there's more variation out there than they think. You know, if everybody that were gay, remember Joanne Lulan used to say, if everybody would come out on a certain day,
right,
we would get over it in a day.
Well,
the whole population would just,
really? She actually not the first one to say that, but that's why we have National Coming Out Day.
Yes.
If everybody did it,
it would have a humongous effect because everybody in this entire country would have to admit that they know more than one gay person because they'd pop up all over the place.
Yeah.
All day, people would be saying, I'm gay.
And so I'm kind of wondering if we had a coming out day specifically for bisexuals. Maybe we would know a little bit more.
Ooh, yeah.
And that it could be that we could have a dialogue where people are more understanding and accepting of that, like I said, the missing part of the GLBT identity.
Right, right.
There is a bisexual organization, Binet USA, and they have a publication, and it's jokingly titled Anything That Moves, because of that reputation that you know that goes along with being bisexual. I always just thought that was hysterical, the man, Mac, who was going to be with us, he's partnered with a male partner. So it's the other side of being a bisexual and being with a same-sex partner. And how do you go about saying, I am bi, I'm not a gay man? Because but that doesn't mean I'm going to act on it.
Yeah, but another thing I think people are afraid of, you know, because we're always having to battle fears and stereotypes and all this kind of thing. People think that bisexual people are going to be more disease prone. They're more likely to be HIV positive, or you know, maybe not careful enough to have enough safe sex because they're dating both genders or whatever. And people just need to be upfront and honest with everybody that they're going to be intimate with and say, yes, I do practice asexual, or no, I don't. And then you can make the decision from there. But, you know, just assuming...
will get you hurt.
Yeah, assuming will get a lot of things.
That's a discussion
happen.
That's really important to have, regardless of who you're going to be with. And you should assume, the only thing you should assume is that the possibility is there that there's... could be danger of infection, not just HIV, which of course is the one most of us would be most concerned about, but all the other STDs and everything mm-hmm. else. So I thank you, Sally and Joy, for being with us on Queer Voices. We will hope to discuss this issue or have more dialogue, because in the last mm-hmm. I don't know how many years we really haven't had people willing to come on and talk about being bisexual, and I think it's an important discussion for us to have.
Yep. So to get a clear definition so that people out there listening can define themselves.
That's right. So thank you for listening to Queer Voices.
straight guy. I want to be a straight guy.
This is Queer Voices.
We've been playing a lot of Jamie Anderson tonight, and she's one of my favorites. So that's
sounds
always,
good.
Yeah,
good music.
I always like to hear her. She's a good person, too. Well, so some reason people picked January 18th to do a whole bunch of things. There's at least three things I know of that are going on that night. And hopefully the weather will be warmer by then so that people will be able to get out and about. We have with us Rodney Waters for Mercuru, the performance branch. Is it, you call it
I
the
would
performance
say that. I would
branch
say that.
Of the AIDS Foundation Houston. And when the Mercuru series started, what, 2 years ago?
A year ago this fall. This is our second full season.
Wow. And how did the idea come about to have a performance series as a been to raise money, to raise funds?
Well, my background is music. I'm a pianist, and even back when I was in college, I was really interested in doing volunteer work and the ways that musicians, because so often all artists do things because they love it, and it's something, a real expression of them. And if it can be combined with a social cause so that there's another good that comes out of, you know, whatever happens with them doing what they love, then it's a win-win situation for everyone. So, you know, I've done different benefit things and wanted for a long time to do something much larger scale. And the opportunity came up a couple of years ago to launch this performance series for AIDS Foundation.
So what is, everybody have to explain all the time, what Mercuru means.
Mercuru is an African deity of compassion and healing.
Oh,
so it
okay.
seemed very appropriate for the name of the series.
And this event coming up on Thursday night, it'll be at Ovations.
That's right.
And it's really special to me because it features the work of women composers and strong songwriters. Tell us a little bit more. It's called Girls Night Out.
Right. Girls Night Out, a concert for everyone. It's not, we're saying it's, you know, the women are the composers of the music, but it's not a strictly X chromosome clientele.
We'll be there that Double evening. X. Thank you.
Double X, exactly. So, yes, it's a concert of women composers and songwriters, with the first half being more of a classical bent, starting with Clara Schumann, one of the first really prolific and amazing composers, wife of Robert Schumann, who was an amazing composer, one of the greatest pianists of her day, and raised 7 children in her spare time.
On top of it.
So, a really amazing
woman.
Was
she from a musical family?
Yes, yes. They met because her father was Robert Schumann's teacher.
Aha.
So,
how sweet.
That's how that happened. And then a lot of work by a local composer, a really wonderful woman and wonderful composer, Mary Carol Warwick, who teaches composition and piano and theory at Houston Community College.
Ah.
And I'd met her several times, but I'd become aware of a series of songs that she wrote in the 90s with texts by people that were HIV positive.
Oh.
And so I became aware of the series and wanted to program some of that on the concert. And then as I got to know more of her music, fell in love with so much of it. The first half has quite a number of her works that I'm very excited about. And from that series called Still We Dance, we're doing 4 songs by an incredible man named Sam Stuman, who will be there Thursday night, 22 years of HIV positive and still going strong.
Oh, how wonderful.
So we'll have both a lot of the literary creatives and the musical creatives there on Thursday night.
So who are some of the other composers or songwriters that people might know?
A wonderful singer in town, Isabel Gantz, who we're doing a piece that she wrote that was used in 1994 as a dedication ceremony to one of the panels for the AIDS quilt. So that also has special meaning. And then the 3 singers on the concert, Kenneth Gale, wonderful tenor, Patricia Rabaza, and Julia Liskowski. Julie and Patty are really amazingly creative people. A lot of the listenership might know them from Always Patsy Cline, that, mm-hmm. that went for like a year and a half or 2 years at Stages. Mm-hmm. And Julia was Patsy, mm-hmm. and Patty was the music director. And incredibly versatile singers, both with classical and pop styles. And really also amazing songwriters. So on the second half, which is much less formal, we're doing some Sarah McLachlan, Indigo Girls, and some original pieces by Patty and Julia also.
There you go. We certainly know.
Well, how can you get tickets and all? How do you contact people?
Just call AIDS Foundation Houston, and I'll give that number slowly.
Please.
713-623-6796, extension 278, to get tickets ahead of time, or tickets also available at the door. It's a 7 p.m. concert at Ovations in the Rice Village Times, right off of Kirby.
The exact address of Ovations is 2536 Times Boulevard, but it faces Kirby, the entrance.
It's on Times. It's on Times.
Yeah, that's right. It's on,
right.
Right by where Main Street Theater is.
You've known it well.
Yes.
There are many times.
And it's a lovely venue. It has, to me, always had that kind of intimate, real nightclub kind of feeling. Like they had, you know, it's very sophisticated. I don't know. There's not a huge amount of seating.
It's not a big space. So no. I would get there early. So, we've already sold quite a number of tickets. It's going to be a big night.
Yeah.
So.
And of course there's a cash bar, and since the seating is limited, you do want to get those tickets early. If you want to find out more about the McCrew series and this event, Music by Women Composers and Songwriters from Clara Schumann to the Indigo Girls, then go to www.mercuru.org. Mercuru is MUKURU, and they'll just be glad to fix you up with tickets. You can just enjoy the night, sit back, relax, have a drink, and experience the music of notable women composers and songwriters at Ovations Nightclub in Rice Village. What is up next after this show?
After this show on February 5th, a really exciting night, timed around National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, a joint production with the Ensemble Theater, the primarily African-American theater, downtown, wonderful theater company. And in that venue, we're having a Zydeco night.
Zydeco.
Great stuff. Step Rito, an incredible band. Step Rito and the Zydeco Outlaws will be performing that night. So the same number for tickets for that, $20 tickets. It's going to be a great night.
I believe we have some music that is some of the stuff that's going to be featured on Thursday, and we'll go to that now. Oh.
wonderful.
Rodney, who is that angelic voice?
Those angelic voices. I was at the keyboard, and that was Patricia Rabaza and Julia Laskowski that will be performing. That was an original piece. And then they're in the process of composing a new musical.
Wow.
And that was a duet between one of the Megan, who's one of the primary characters, is a 10-year-old musical genius in a really tiny town, and her parents don't know what to do with her, and so they take her to the town psychic to find out what's going to happen to her. And that's the meeting between the psychic and the 10-year-old girl when they feel have this connection with each other. So, really
wow.
Beautiful piece.
Do you know when that's going to be ready?
No, they're still coming up with incredible songs like that.
Will that be a recurring feature, or are they gonna...
I don't know. You know, everything's still okay.
Well,
in process.
Make sure they know to let us know so that we can promote it on Queer Voices. We're talking with Rodney Waters, the Arts for AIDS Artistic Director at the AIDS Foundation Houston, the Mercuru Performance Series, and this Thursday night, Girls Night Out, a concert for everyone. It'll be at Ovations Nightclub over in the Village on Times Boulevard. You can call 713-623-6796 at extension 278.
That's right.
And you can look up on the web mercuru.org. Our AIDS Foundation Houston website will get you there, too, I am sure. Is there anything that you want to let our listeners know that we didn't ask you about?
I would just say, with the Mercuru series, all of the proceeds that are raised specifically go to HIV prevention programs locally in Houston. And actually, they don't stay with AIDS Foundation. We are one of 29 cities that get a match from the National AIDS Fund and the Elton John AIDS Fund, which is a 50% match. So every dollar raised by the Mercuru Arts for AIDS series, 50 cents is matched by the National AIDS Fund, and all of it goes out into the community for local HIV prevention programs.
Oh, and boy, prevention is the name of the game.
Sure,
because if people can stay free of HIV, then that's the biggest part
that's
of
right.
the battle. And until... even if we find a cure, when we find a cure. So I thank you, Rodney, for being with us and telling us about this and sharing that wonderful music. I really
Thanks
look
so
forward
much.
To Thursday night. I told Rodney I was going to celebrate my birthday by going to see
wonderful.
This. And thank you all for listening to Queer Voices. Go
thank
out
you.
And support Mercuru.
Thank you, Rodney.
Better than sex. Better than sex.
Better than sex.
Once I had a lover. I met him at a show. He was singing back up. His voice was smooth and low. He gave me such a look. I couldn't tell him no. His nickname was T-Rex. And so I said, let's go. He touched me here, he touched me there, he touched me every kind of way. Sweeping up the set. His hands were big and rugged, with hair you'd love to pet. He looked so mean and dirty, he got close as he could get. First time I didn't fake him.
Delicious.
And then our eyes met. He touched me here, he touched me there, he touched me every kind of way. Sex.
Well, that was another song from the performance that will be on Thursday night over at Ovations. And so that's just some more of the sampling of the music that you'll enjoy on Thursday night.
We are going to talk about what's been going on with Pride Houston. On Thursday, there was a meeting, an impromptu meeting, by a number of people that John Netschman called together, of people who were hearing about that. It seemed like it was a done deal at the time that Pride Houston had decided to move the parade date till the last weekend in September and move it, the location, from Montrose to downtown. That group sort of got together and almost entirely put a letter together saying that there's a number of reasons that why we didn't want it moved. And then Saturday was a session put on by Pride Houston where about 50 people attended. And the task force that came with the recommendation to move the parade downtown and move the time of year celebration put that recommendation together, but it seemed as though, and now let me distance myself. I'm founder of Pride Houston, one of the founders, one of the three founders, and I also was employed by Pride Houston, but no, I am no longer associated with them because I left them back about 2 months ago. Yet I still want to see us have the best, you know, Pride celebration that we could possibly have. And over this time, there were some remarks made by some people about Pride Houston about how they need to bring the levels of the parade up, meaning that they may need to exclude some people. So the meeting that happened on Thursday basically talked about some of those things that they felt that they were not, that they didn't agree with that. And then Saturday's meeting was more or less, this is what the task force has recommended. And then tonight, what didn't happen tonight, the board of Pride Houston was supposed to vote on that recommendation. But my understanding, there was a commitment made that they will postpone that vote and discuss it a little bit further. Sally Huffer was at both meetings, and
that's because she's bisexual. She can go to both meetings.
She goes to both meetings.
And she certainly has been a strong supporter of Pride, you know, and celebrating Pride, especially with her association with the Counseling Center and Hatch that works, you know, as part of the Counseling Center, and the Switchboard.
But I've also done some individual volunteer work in the office,
you know,
working on the database, and that was just me personally going into volunteer.
Mm-hmm. And then last Monday, we had Jeffrey on to talk about what was being said and some of the ideas. And
that sort of spawned the articles in the Chronicle because Alan Turner was listening to the radio show.
Well, I'm glad somebody's listening.
Yeah, I know.
But the call-ins was a good idea, bringing in more input from our community.
One of the callers that called last week and made some excellent comments. Later, she says, "Good grief! If they can't stand in the heat in the end of June, what kind of queers are they?
Well,
if they can't stand the heat, just stay out of the parade."
And the reality is that at the end of September, it's not that much cooler.
No,
no.
I think October is a much better month.
I mean, when we got 75 degrees in January.
You know, I think where a lot of us are coming from, especially those of us that are aware of the history of the community and how the parades got started and everything, and a book that must be read for anyone who is queer, certainly, but I would recommend it to everyone, is the book about Stonewall by David Carter, because when you see what was going on, I mean, it was a hot night that night in New York City, and that didn't stop them from doing what they did, which in a lot of ways was, as I say, it was the first time we fought back. That's the significance of we've had enough of this and we're not going to take it anymore.
Well,
because there was already a movement in place.
Well,
we interviewed David Carter on this radio show.
I think one of the things with Pride making these changes or considering these changes is a lot of people in the community felt that their input wasn't being, you know,
heard
about this. And so for many of us, it was very difficult to get beyond the process in order to consider what was on the table. And for many who felt excluded, the resentment meant that they already had a preconceived idea. And so even considering, well, is this a good idea or is this not a good idea? You know, it was really hard to set that aside to be able to focus on what was being decided.
And pride, very much the parade, is a passionate subject to a lot of people in the community because it means so much. And as Deb Murphy talked about the Hatch kids coming to town, and this is something, you know, they read about, they heard about, and they actually get to see it. And also that turning on mantra on Westheimer, the Westheimer curve, and when you just turn that corner and when you're in the parade and you see all those people there, it's pretty incredible.
Oh, one of my favorite things in the parade is I always end up going through the parade backwards because I'm usually sitting on the end of a truck or the end of our float and handing out beads and Safer Sex packets and switchboard magnets to all of our people so that they can hand it out to the people in the parade. But my moment for the parade is when it crosses Westheimer and Montrose and I look up, and I know it didn't happen this last year, but when I can see that disco ball, when I can see that chandelier, and I just have that moment of, you know, and one of the things that I talked about at the meeting on Saturday, for me personally, I mean, I'm a very large woman, and I don't mean just I'm a large woman. I'm a very large woman, and oftentimes I've worked on these floats. Sometimes
a woman of size and proud of.
And so the heat, the June heat is really tough on me. I mean, as an individual. And yet, when all is said and done, when Pride is over, when that whole weekend is passed, and I've gone through the festival, and I've set up everything, and we've done the parade, I don't feel like I've ever had more righteous sweat in my life. I mean, for me, I feel like, you know, if that's the least I can give, come on.
Yeah. One of the first thoughts that I had, because one of the things that was being said, that they might take some of the smaller groups out of the parade so that it would move more, you know, feng shui or something, and then I thought about who those small groups might be, such as the older lesbian group Loaf, and I thought, well, then are they going to give Loaf a special seating section and allow them to, you know, have some kind of special banner or something? And the transgender contingency in the parade, that's often a very small group.
Yeah, we have a float there, and we've had a float for the last three prides. But before, there was virtually nothing, just a bunch of us walking down the street, basically.
And then I also thought about, like, because I've seen people working on their float and you know, planning it, and there's kind of an excitement, and, like, we're doing this together. And certainly I remember one time over at the community center when it was on Hawthorne, and that they were doing things, you know, in the backyard there, and it was just like, you know, this is us, and we're going to be there, and we're going to be, everyone will be seeing us, and it's all, you know, community, it's about the community. And I think that feeling of people feeling like they just weren't asked, even though Pride, to its credit, is doing a survey. It's on the website. You can take part that way. They did have a couple of meetings that weren't very well attended before they had this meeting. And
part of that, too, is because we're all busy. You know, we're all busy, and we've got things. And one of those, I mean, the one of those meetings was right before the election. A lot of us were working
on the elections,
election.
Yes.
And, you know, we're busy. And sometimes until we think something's going to change or being challenged or go away, we don't always get involved, and that was part of it. And you know, but the stakeholders in the community are the people who, you know, work in the parade, work or volunteer for organizations that are in the parade. And I think, you know, certainly every organization needs to do some long range planning and needs to look, you know, so that they become they stay relevant to the next generation. And there's a lot of positive things about the possibility of moving it downtown, because the festival, and I know this, is pretty much, you can't do much more at the festival from where
it's currently located.
You know, on the other hand, the parade does work where it is. Now, and also, you can't separate the two or one work.
You know, one of the things that is kind of it for me is when I come down to Westheimer and I see those rainbow banners, are the pink triangles that they put up some years. It's like, I think it was Brian Keever that got the Banner District.
The Banner District.
Yeah. And so right there, that's like, well, why, you know, it's Westheimer and Montrose. It's right along there. And are they going to then put the banners all the way down whatever street downtown?
Well,
the
Banner
parade
district,
goes there.
The Banner District is something that is owned by Pride Houston with the city of Houston. You can't just move it because downtown is a different Banner District.
So,
now, whether they can negotiate, and that I think is a small part of this whole big picture, whether they can negotiate with the downtown Banner District to put them down there.
Did they say at the meeting on Saturday, because unfortunately I was not able to attend, some things that people were in favor of, or was there anything that, like,
well,
people I didn't realize it was going to be that?
Most of the people that were there felt that the decision was already made, number one. Number two, they felt that they were excluded from being part of that decision-making process. And number three, they thought that Pride Houston was talking a lot more about people coming in as visitors rather than the people who were here, who are the community. And there was many other things. They thought that the survey that was online was flawed because you couldn't answer some of the things and you had to answer certain questions before you can go forward. They also thought that Pride Houston was doing this to make more money, which I don't think that was true.
Of course, if Pride Houston makes money, one, it goes back into Pride Houston to for the next year, or I think there was even some talk about there could be some scholarships or something positive for the community that came out of it. But the idea that was offensive to me was to be worried about having people come here from other places to bring their tourist dollars rather than it being for the community that is here.
Well, and I do want to go back for a second. You had Jeffrey on last week on the program, and Jeffrey Cuellar, the director of operations, I believe that's
his title. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's his title.
A few weeks back at the Futures Conference, several of us were at the community center talking about, what's happened since the Futures Conference a few years ago and where are we headed now. And Jeffrey had just been hired by the Pride Committee and poor guy showed up. And so some of us had articulated that we had heard all these rumors about all the changes that were going on, and yet we felt excluded. And I think to his credit and to Pride Houston's credit that they put this meeting together on Saturday to get more public opinion, because, you know, they had gone through their process already. And so like I said, to their credit, I think that they should be commended for, and it could not have been an easy meeting for them to walk into on Saturday, because I'm sure that they anticipated a lot of passion. Well, a lot of passion.
Yes.
But sometimes that does brim over into fiery speech and language and, you know, some of that. And so it couldn't have been an easy thing for them to take on, and I commend them for doing it.
And I certainly think it's much to their credit that they're saying, you know, maybe we were in haste, or maybe we need to examine this again and revisit it and make a better decision.
It actually came from the audience, from our one and only Jack Valinsky.
Oh! Jack thinks that way.
Well, it was definitely a solution that I think that those people, like myself, who were at the meeting, felt was a reasonable way to move forward instead of, I mean, this meeting could have gone on, 4 or 5 hours.
Yes.
And well, so it was a good solution.
My dear friend Ray Hill blames this whole thing on me, of course, but that's...
Because if you were still the executive director of Pride, we wouldn't have to be worried about this.
The executive director works for the board of directors.
So yes, but you also formed leadership and knew the players and you always have a democratic approach to what you do.
Well, thank you. In fact, I did actually volunteer to chair this task force, but they thought it would be better to have an outside firm that supposedly volunteered their time to do it, and that's the way they went. And unfortunately, they didn't know the territory, as comes from the Music Man, which is really sad. And it's like, where do they go from here? They had a board meeting tonight. My understanding was they were going to just discuss it more and not make any decisions, but I'm not sure where they go from here.
Well, maybe in a couple of weeks weeks on Queer Voices, we can have them on to talk some more about it, maybe take call-ins again. I just urge people to read the survey, even if you don't answer everything. But if we want... Whatever we want as a community is what they need to convey, so that at the end of the day, what we get is what we want.
And voice yourself. You know, take the time to get online, come to the meetings, voice your opinion. In this case, this has to do, you know, we talk about politics, we talk about voting for people, and we work for people. This is about working for our own community. This is about the heart of our community is here in Montrose.
Well said.
And do we want to move the heart? Do we want a heart transplant? I don't think that's going to work. I don't know. That's my opinion. But I've got to express my opinion. No. I'm part of this community. I love the parade where it is. It's hot. We moved it to the nighttime. My God, it was daytime. It's still fun. And it's all about a celebration of our own pride in who we are. That's what's important.
Well said, Jennifer. Before we close off, which we need to do, do you have any other statements about it?
Well, and I chaired the, you know, the nighttime parade task force, and not everybody agreed with it at that time, but a lot more people did. And it turned out to be the best thing we ever did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's thank our guest.
Yes. Well, we want to thank Aaron Coleman for that beautiful spoken word about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Bayard Rustin. Joan is speaking with Axel Nisan, who is in Oslo. So he didn't have any accent. I was amazed.
Could have an English accent.
Well, that's because he's the professor of American Studies at the University of Oslo about the book Actresses of a Certain Character. And then we talked to Sally Huffer and Joy Petrano about being
Bisexual.
Oh, come on, loud and proud. Bisexual.
Okay. And then Rodney Waters for the McCrew Performance Series benefiting AIDS Foundation Houston. That'll be Thursday night. Also on Thursday night, Alley Theaters has its Act Out series. This is Eugene O'Neill's play Moon for the Misbegotten, and you can check with the Alley Theater for the details about that play next week on Queer Voices.
Yes. We talk with Jason Stevens, the new artistic director of the Houston Pride Band, about their upcoming concert on January 25th. We will also have This Way Out, the internationally syndicated news magazine. And on J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, he presents his interview with feminist music singer, songwriter,
Trett.
Trett Ferry.
Yeah, and he says it's a two-hour interview on the website. So
that's great.
You tune in next week on Queer Voices.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.